So anyways, I'll give it to Myers. It always cracks me up. It always cracks me up when anybody shows up again. It's just like somebody will come and listen to a talk, but if they come back again, they already know what they're in for, and so it's always exciting to see. For the guys that I didn't meet, my name is Myers Raymer, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, y'all. And for those sleepy boys and girls that aren't here yet this morning, they're just going to be screwed because they're not going to actually know what's going on, and that's okay. We'll just look at them in a judgmental way and convict them so they feel all... You know, two things we probably need to cover ahead of time. Like, your schedule is fairly useless. We're sensitive to the fact that guys need to smoke and go to the bathroom and things like this, and so we're not going to drone on about stuff. We'll have plenty of time for breaks, we'll get you guys out of here in early enough this afternoon that you still have some weekend to do some other things too. You know, I was talking to this guy a little bit ago, and we're talking about. I know some of you guys have been sober for a long time. And you work this work, and you did this thing, and this is not an attempt to judge in any form or fashion the way anybody's doing anything. If it took you 2 years to work the work and you got through it okay, terrific. These are simply observations and reflections of two guys who have been through the work and have seen things that tend to not work real well, like take your time doing the work. I mean, it rolls off the tongue real nice, and we're taught that a lot, and yet my own personal experience didn't work like that. It wasn't like that at all. The longer I took to do something, the more time I spent in pain and anguish. It was only when I got more vigilant and more diligent in working the work that I got some relief, emotional relief, around what was kicking my rear end, you see? And so... we'll go through and explain that deal. Remember that everything that we're doing about this is geared more towards sponsorship than anywhere else. We're going to assume, for the sake of this conversation in here, that everybody that's here wants to sponsor somebody, or two bodies, or 10 bodies, or 30 bodies. We're assuming that you want to do that, that you desire to do that, because that's what the literature asks us to do. The book said you need to go do this. Bill Wilson and those guys never assumed that what we were going to do was that we were going to get sober and we would be an island unto ourselves and we're never going to sponsor anybody. It was never intended that. He figured that as soon as we were sober and as soon as we were ready to go, that we'd be out there kicking butt, taking names, and helping people recover. That's what he assumed we were going to do. And yet that's not the reality in this stuff, guys. I at the present time, I've sponsored a little group of guys that are chronic. They're just nut jobs. All of these guys are approaching 20 years of sobriety, this little group of guys. And within that little group of guys, they've sponsored collectively, those five men have sponsored five men. Now, do you understand what I just said? There's five guys that have a total... years of sobriety of over 100 years, and collectively between them, they've sponsored five men. No wonder I'm so tired. I'm doing their work too. It's crazy.
Oh yes, I sponsor a man.
How nice for you. Why aren't you sponsoring 20 men? Because there's 100 out there dying. Come on, let's go. And that's where we need everybody to get. And then it would be a lot easier on all of us, and we'd have a fellowship that was so strong and so vibrant and so ready to go that it would scare you. You'd walk into a room blown away by how vibrant everything was. And that's the way it should be. And my experience has been is that when we get everybody on the same page, this common solution that we talked about last night, when we get everybody on that same page, that's the experience. Some of you guys have been to Dallas, Texas. There's two or three of you guys that have traveled to the States, and you were in our meeting on a Tuesday night where 200 people are sitting there studying the big book. And guys, it is... excuse me. It's the craziest thing you've ever seen. It's like a circus in that room. 200 people, all excited about recovery, all just going nuts. It's like they all have little extension cords plugged right up their rear end, and they're all just all plugged in and vibrating. They're just, it's exciting stuff because we know exactly what our primary purpose is. Everybody's real focused about what it is that we need to be doing. And I see that to a large extent here already in the guys that I've talked to. I've talked to a lot of guys that are really plugged in. The deal is that so many of us get the crap kicked out of us out there in mainstream AA. We get all excited about stuff, and then we walk into a meeting, and there's a bunch of old guys in there saying exactly the opposite of what we're trying to get guys to do. And it's daunting. It's tough, and I know that. And my heart bleeds for you because I see it all the time. And I just the best advice I can give you is just do exactly what you're doing. Just keep going out there, sharing the truth out of the book, and watch what happens. One of the areas I'm gonna talk about 1, 2, and 3 this morning briefly, and then for about 1 hour and 10 minutes or so, and then Peter's gonna flesh that out. He's gonna spend some time in it and slide into 4 and 5, and we're gonna get through this stuff. We'll be glad to answer questions the early part of the afternoon. We'll get into some question and answer stuff so that we can shore up some loose ends on this stuff. Let's pretend, for the sake of this example, for the sake of this talk, let's pretend that Daniel is my goofy little drunk that just came in. He's been sober for 2 days, and he's sitting in a meeting detoxing. He's a nutcase, and he's tried to do this thing for years. It's in and out and in and out. You know the kind of guy, a little arrogant pissant, and he's just. Daniel is a perfect example of this. Okay. One of the greatest lies that we've been sold in AA, one of the greatest pieces of disservice to this fellowship, has been this idea that anybody that wants to be here can be here, and that we'll leave them alone when they're here. They have every right to be here. They do. I'm not saying anything. I'm not trying to be exclusive to anybody. I'm just trying to tell you, when a man walks into a room, let's say this is our AA meeting right here, we're sitting right here, and Daniel walks in and sits down. And he's in here and he's uncomfortable. We go over, maybe we greet him a little bit, we do. And that's where it stops in most AA groups. We greet him. We make him feel comfortable. Nothing wrong with that. I love making people feel comfortable. However, there seems to be this thing. You talk about something, the Q word, qualifying this guy, and all of a sudden it's a nasty deal. Everybody gets all you can't qualify him. Yes, I can. The book begs me to do it. The book asks me over and over and over again to care. Why do you think Bill Wilson spent 40 some odd pages in the front of this book talking about that one thing? Trying to get us to understand the truth around the allergic reaction and the mental obsession. Page after page, description after description, illustration after illustration of, so we could understand why it is that we do the crazy things that we do. Let's touch on this just for a minute, okay? Because we're going to scoop this little kid up, this Daniel guy, and we're going to qualify him as he comes in. Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob in the first 100 knew and understood that when these guys come in here, the very first thing we need to do is to see if we can help them see their truth. Do I label him an alcoholic? No way. It's not my job to label anybody anything. But I need to help Daniel understand what his truth is around his drinking. Why? Because if Daniel has any ambivalence at all in his guts about what he is, he's going to falter downrange. You've seen it over and over and over again. Guys that come in. Listen, the saddest thing that I see in AA today is men and women sitting in meetings 10 years sober, still ambivalent about their disease. Still not really sure if they're a drunk. You see what I'm saying? And they go back and they think of the drama that got them here. Oh yeah, well I got the DWI. That must mean I'm an alcoholic. No, it doesn't. Guys, let me tell you something. The world is full of badly behaved guys that drink and drug and do weird crap, and they wreck cars and they wreck families and they wreck jobs and they do all of this other kind of stuff, but it does not make them an alcoholic. We all cool so far on this? We want to make the distinction because the distinction is important. Just because a man is in our meeting doesn't mean he's an alcoholic. Please. Just because that lady that came in and sat down next to you in a meeting, just because she's there, doesn't mean she's an alcoholic. She could be a badly behaved drunk. They describe it, page 19, 20, and 21. They give you a perfect description of it. They do it again over in the chapter to the wives. They bust this thing down into what class of drunk is your husband. They tell you this stuff so that you can see what you got. How many of you guys know, I better look at that. How many of you guys know people that drank just like you And at some point in time, they quit just on their own. They just stopped. We all do. We all run across guys like this. I had guys that I drank with for the whole time, and I'd always think they were just like me. And then their wife says, "You know what, pal? I'm done with your crap, and I'm leaving if you don't stop drinking." And I've got two or three friends that stopped just like that. Never walked into a meeting, never did anything else. They could quit. The book tells us that the heavy drinker can stop or moderate on his own, given sufficient reason. The doctor says, "Buddy, your liver looks terrible. You're going to have to stop." Okay, it's time to stop. And they just pull up and stop. Everybody has an uncle. Oh, my uncle, he stopped 20 years ago and he never did any AA or anything. He just stopped. He was a bad alcoholic. Oh, was he? I would like to argue that. I don't think that he was an alcoholic. I think that he was a heavy drinker that pulled up and stopped because he could. He could stop or moderate on a non-spiritual basis, which in that definition keeps him outside that realm of alcoholism as it is. That's why we need to understand this, and that's the reason why Bill spent so much time talking about that stuff. If you don't understand what Bill and Bob and those guys were trying to do, the whole first part of the book takes on a real boring cachet. Because they give you Jim's story and Fred's story and the Jaywalker story and all this other, the Man of 30, all of these illustrations, and you're just going like, "Bill, get on with it. Come on, let's get into the steps. Let's get into..." And it took me a long time to realize what it was that they were trying to do. They were trying to say, if you don't understand the chronic nature of alcoholism, we get worse, never better. If you don't understand that nature of the mental obsession and the allergic reaction, you'll never do the stuff that you have to do on over in the deal. Because we're going to ask you to do some pretty goofy things on over here. We're going to ask you to turn your will and your life over to care of a loving God in three. We're going to ask you to do inventory. We're going to ask you to make restitution. And trust me, if you don't understand here, this is not an intellectual exercise, right? If we don't get you to understand right here what's going on, guys, you will suffer mightily on down the road. You'll simply, at the first point where things get goofy, translate that hard, you're going to just put it at a distance. You ever hear of a guy that comes out of the starting block and he's ready to do anything you want him to do, and then he just loses momentum? You get him up around step three, and then you get him ready for inventory, and all of a sudden he just loses. It's like somebody unplugged his rear end and all of his juices flowed out on the floor, and he's not going to do anything. He's lost his steam. The analogy last night that we were talking to with Danny about this stuff, about if somebody told this cat that he had cancer, there is no losing steam if you have a path set. If I know I have cancer that's consuming my body as I sit here, and I have a path of action that tells me what I need to do to get clear of it, did you ever see a cancer patient that's ambivalent about his recovery process? As a general rule, that's not the case, is it? As a general rule, they go, "What do I do next? Is there anything I can do while I'm doing this? Is it Monday? You want me there? I'm there." You ever see anybody miss a cancer treatment? It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. Why doesn't it happen? It doesn't happen because there is no ambivalence in this man about his disease. He knows he's screwed. We're all clear there? Okay. I haven't started speaking in tongues yet. We don't do that till I get to the inventory part of this. And that's the reason why when we get Daniel in there, Daniel's first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's detoxing in the meeting, and he's called, I don't want to hear him share. I don't want to hear him talk. I don't want to hear him. I just want to ask him some questions. "Daniel, I already love you enough. Let's talk about some of this stuff and see where you are. If when you honestly want to, you find that you cannot quit." Look at page 44. Let's just read through this real quick and see. People say all the time, when you get a brand new guy, do you start at the title page? Nuh-uh. I don't waste my time. Why would I want to start at the title page talking about stuff that this guy may or may not even need? Let's find out who we got in the room first. And that's the reason why we can go through this stuff. The reason why the early AA was so effective was because they did this. They qualified their guys first. If I got me a guy that's just a heavy drinker, I don't waste time reading the book. I'm busy. I have jillions of guys out there dying that need this deal. You understand what I'm saying? And that's the reason why. And it's not unkind to do that.
People say, well, if somebody had qualified me when I first got here, I'd have left. Okay, believe that if you want. Guys, one of the greatest regrets of my life, one of the things that bothered me the most was that for 7 years I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and nobody qualified me. Nobody helped me see my truth. We assume that the new guy, we assume that this little knucklehead Daniel is going to know what to ask, that's going to know and understand his disease. And that is ludicrous. That's crap. You know it is. Daniel doesn't know anything. Except every day when he gets up, he says, I'm not going to do this today. And every night when he passes out, he goes, I did it again. I did it again. Tomorrow will be different. And he's repeated that exercise over and over and over. And you did exactly the same thing, I bet, didn't you? We have tens of thousands of drunks sitting in meetings every day that still don't understand why they drink the way they drink. Why do I do the things that I do? And finally, they settle on the old threadbare idea that I'm just a weak, spineless little bastard. They do. And you know, at 7 years sober, sitting in meetings, that's exactly what I'm thinking. At the end of the day, I don't really know why. I guess I'm just weak. I guess I'm just exactly what my mom said I was and what my wife said I was. I didn't realize that I had a disease that was kicking my rear end. I didn't realize that I had a body that processed alcohol different than the normal people. I didn't know any of that. And why should Daniel have to sit in a meeting for 7 or 10 or 15 years not knowing that? 10 years into the deal, he's a crappy sponsor, and we want to make all kinds of excuses why he's a crappy sponsor. I'll tell you why he's a lousy sponsor. He's a bad sponsor because he doesn't understand what to teach. It's as simple as that. He just doesn't know. He's been spoon-fed a lot of people's views of AA who loved him to death, but they didn't understand either. You see, it's a tragic circle. It's a weird circle that we get ourselves into. It would be easier if there were a bunch of evil, nasty people out there saying a bunch of unkind things, and then we could judge them and say, that's the reason this didn't happen. Come on, guys, you know that's not true. There's more love and more affection and more genuine concern for men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous than any other place I have ever been on the face of this earth. But we have a whole bunch of people that made the conscious decision to take the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and slide it sideways and set it down. And now it's about fellowship. We had two sides of this deal. We had a fellowship end of the deal and we had a program end of the deal. And the program end of the deal got set aside in most of our meetings. And that's the reason why we talk nonstop about things that don't need to be discussed in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to talk about that thing tomorrow at some length. We'll talk about that specifically. If you got your book out and you were over on page 44, they're going to ask you these two questions at the deal. My very first meeting with Daniel, we're going to sit there and I'm going to say, Daniel, let me ask you a question. Let me make sure he's got some literature, and I'm going to hand him this book and I'm going to say, turn to page 44. And we go, in the preceding chapters, I'm at the top of that page. In the preceding chapters, we've learned something about alcoholism. We did. We got 51 pages before this that told us everything that we needed to know, basically, about the disease part of this deal. We hope we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. Two distinctions right there, right? Two distinctions. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. In one paragraph, I've given this guy the exact what he needs to know to qualify himself for whether or not he's a drunk or not, whether or not he's the real deal alcoholic. Is he a disco drunk? Is he just a badly behaved bum? Or is he a real alcoholic? That's the distinction that we need to make. And then it also, at the bottom of the paragraph, tells us exactly what we're going to have to do to recover. It didn't say, which only 90 meetings in 90 days will cure. It didn't say that. A spiritual experience. And the only way I know to get this spiritual experience is work the steps. That's it. You may be able to do it another way. If you find a way, tell me. It may be easier than this and I'll be doing it your way. So in that deal, I'm going to ask Daniel. I said, Daniel, if you honestly want to stop, it's like given that choice. If you tell yourself, I'm never going to do this again. Let's put it in a personal deal like this. Let's say that his girlfriend says, I'm out of here. If you drink again, I'm gone. Daniel says, I'm not going to drink again.
And then 3 days later, he finds himself drunk. He's lost the power of choice. Check. Choice. Okay. If he says, Iris, I'm going to stop after work and I'm going to have one beer with these guys down at the plant and then I'm going to go home. I'll see you for dinner. And he has six. He's lost the power of control. Check. Control. You understand what I'm saying? He's it. I don't give a rat's patootie about everything else Daniel wants to tell me. Daniel wants to tell me about his DWI. He wants to tell me about the night he whacked the crap out of Iris. He wants to tell me about all of this other stuff. He wants to tell me about all this drama that went down. And none of it makes him an alcoholic. None of it does. Are we clear here, guys? It's important that we are, because from this foundation, we're going to launch into the rest of this stuff. And that's why it's important that we get all in agreement around this deal. Your drama did not make you an alcoholic. The fact that a cop whacked you on the upside of the head didn't make you an alcoholic. The fact that your mom put you on the toilet seat backwards when you were a little kid did not make you an alcoholic. You can go anywhere you want to around it, but the book tells us we have two qualifications. If you lost the power of choice and control, and if you have, welcome. You're it. You're screwed. But there is a solution. This is good, you see, and we understand this. But see, if you know it from that level, this point of discomfort that lies in the pit of my stomach, that there is no wiggle room, that I am actually doomed to a horrible death and everybody that I know with me. At the point that that realization is made, I can make my beginning from there. And the motivation is there to keep and continue doing everything that needs to be done. Eat a cat turd? Where is it? I'll eat it. I'll do anything. Whatever it is, I'll do it. Because that's what I'm going to have to do in order to recover. You see what I'm saying? Let me ask you this question, guys. How many of you guys have ever gone to a treatment center and you did a little talk and you picked up some guy out of this treatment center and he says, hey, I want you to sponsor me. I just got here in this treatment deal, and you can look in his eyes and he's just desperate. He's just had the crap kicked out of him and he's just, oh, it's just horrible. And you, what you have is this little compliant guy that's ready to do the work. And you're all excited and you think, oh, this is the greatest stuff in the whole wide world. And so you say, you bet, I'm going to sponsor you and I'll be back in a week. And so you come back in a week, next time you're back up there and you walk in and you're looking at this guy and something's a little bit different, you know. And you kind of go, I wonder. And so you talk a little bit and he's still willing. He's still giving you the right answers. Yes, I'll do this and yes, I'll do this and yes, I read this and yes, and like this. And you go, okay, well, okay, I'll see you in another week. And about that time it's going to be about ready for you to get out of here and we'll really start in earnest what we're doing with this work. And you go, great. So you go back in again the following week and you walk in the room and he doesn't even look like the same guy that you talked to 2 weeks ago. This little guy that was all beat up and compliant and ready to do anything he could do to get through the work is now this arrogant little pissant like this with his arms folded like this. And all we call it the AA Trinity, the job, the girl, and the car. That's all he cares about. All he cares about is how to get my job back so I can get my car back so I can get my girl back. You see it? You've been there. You know exactly what I'm talking about. This guy could care less about your stinking steps. And the only reason he's even considering AA is because his counselor's leaning on his back every day to get involved in an AA group. That's it. Because he doesn't really feel like he's got the problem anymore. They fed him enough good food. They fed him enough knowledge. And he's bulletproof. And let me tell you something. This arrogant little guy is destined to have a real awakening when he steps out on the street and life slaps him upside the head. He'll be at the dope house or the drunk store in just like that. Because he didn't really believe that he had the problem. They talk about a lurking notion. If there's any lurking notion that there's another way to do this, you'll do that. And that's the reason why early AA didn't play with you. They didn't mess with you. If Daniel's arguing with me and he's got other ideas about how, well, what I think I'm going to do for a while is I'm going to go to church with my wife and we're going to try to get back into that deal. I say, Daniel, I love you to death and I'm delighted that that's what you're going to do. You go ahead and do that. If you need me, here's my card. And that's it. I'm done with Daniel for a little while. Now, there are those out there that say, no, we need to love him and get him and get him involved and get him all like, why? I don't understand. Why would we want to spend any more time with Daniel? Their lurking notion is there. He's going to run it again. The game is going to run out. And as it plays back out again, and he leaves church and he goes to the beer store because the football game's getting ready to start, and he's drunk again in no time, and then he whacks Iris up the side of the head again, and she calls me and said, well, he did it again. I'm going, Iris, I've been asking you. You need to probably get out of that deal until we get this thing worked out. badly behaved. And finally, Daniel calls me again and he says, okay, I'm ready to listen. Now, this time, Daniel's not talking a lot. This time, Daniel's not trying to tell me all the crap that he's going. He's not trying to run any games on me. He's desperate. He knows he's in trouble and he's going to die if he doesn't do something. Now I have the Daniel that I need. Now I have the guy that's ready. Isn't it funny that the book keeps telling us in the early part of the book, they keep using this illustration of going back out and doing some controlled drinking. If you think you can do this, go do some controlled drinking. And everybody sucks in this collective breath like, you wouldn't suggest that a guy do that? Heck, I wouldn't. I do it every week. If you don't think that you belong here, go drink. Let me tell you something, guys. I can't talk anybody into recovery. I can't. I've never been able to do it. You tell me this. What was it that your parents told you that made you stop drinking? Huh? They didn't. Come on, guys. Sometimes the very best thing that can happen is for these guys to go back out, make another run at it, realize how absolutely hopeless this thing is one more time, and then they'll all get gathered up and they'll say, I'm ready. And the difference is phenomenal. Guys, the spiritual experience that we're after manifests itself in physical ways, tangible ways. You see it happening. I talk to guys all the time, but I've been sponsoring this guy for a year, and we're almost through the work. And I'm just going to, I always go, okay, why are you still doing step work with this guy a year from the time that you started with him? Why? This guy's either ready to do the stuff or he's not ready to do the stuff. It's black and white, guys. It's black and white. He's either ready or he's not. If he's not, leave him alone. Let him go do something else. If he's ready, I know some of you guys are looking at me like, I can't believe he's saying that. I didn't say it. The book said it. The literature said it. They're crystal clear on this stuff. Go read chapter 7, Working with Others, and watch what happens on this stuff. They tell these guys, don't waste your time. If he's not ready, leave him be. You'll screw it up for on down the road. Leave him be. He'll come back, we hope. He may not, but that's not my deal. I'm not responsible whether he comes back or not. I'm responsible just to get him through the deal if he's ready to do the work. As we work, listen, I've sponsored hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of guys, and I've never taken more than a month to work anybody through the work. Never, ever. You don't need to. The book was clear that we go get through this stuff. They use words like action and more action, and they over and in. Read at the end of every step and watch what it says right after that step. Now it's time for more action, you know. There is no reason for Daniel to suffer. Turn over to page 24, halfway down the page. Let's look at this thing real quick. First third of the page, excuse me. The fact that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. They're talking about the mental component of alcoholics of an alcoholic. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. This, guys, is the stuff that we're talking about. This is the stuff that we have to understand this. The idea that a man or a woman is going to be able to come into our fellowship and maintain a life without booze for any determined length of time is ludicrous. And where we got it, I swear I don't know. I swear I don't know. It's just, the book just told me that I won't remember the pain and suffering of even a week or a month ago. Think about the worst thing that ever happened to you guys. Think about the I got raped in a jail cell one night. Fun? Not for me, it wasn't. But what was I doing 10 hours later? I was drunker than a skunk 10 hours later. You see what I'm saying? I couldn't remember with sufficient force the pain and suffering. And we assume that the war stories are going to do it and all the other stuff that we talk about in these meetings is going to do it. Buddy, let me tell you something. I can't even remember my own pain and suffering. What makes you think I'm going to remember yours? It's crazy. We need to stop taking up thousands and thousands of hours a week in AA are spent with people telling war stories in meetings. I understand the nature of identity. I understand that we need to identify, but we don't need to identify that much. We don't. It's not necessary. There's a perfect place for a story like that, and it's called a 12-step call. Daniel and I are going to do it. When I first talked to him, when he was sitting in the meeting, I'm going to tell him a little bit about myself, and he's going to go, yeah, I know that. Yeah, I know that. And then I'm going to ask him a little bit, and he's going to share some stuff back with me. I'm going to go, yeah, I relate. We've connected and we've related. That's all the identity we need to do. We don't need to go back through this war story crap every time because there's too much other good stuff to talk about. There's too much other solution stuff to talk about. Y'all are cool on that. Most of you guys are like you are already there. So understand this deal. In this first meeting, this first setup with Daniel, we've qualified him. He knows that he's lost the power of choice and control. He's the real deal alcoholic. We talk to him about the allergic reaction. They talk about it there on page 24. They talk about the allergic part of this deal. We all know that. There's nobody in here that doesn't understand. Once I start, I can't stop. The physical part of this is the easiest thing for us to understand. We got into the mental part of it. Now it's a lot harder to understand because of that mental component. Why is it stone cold sober? Why is it no booze anywhere in my body? Do I still find myself picking up the drink? That queer mental blank spot that they talk about in the deal. The mental obsession is much harder for us to understand, and that's the reason why Bill spent all of that time. All of those stories, Jim's story, Fred's story, all of those illustrations are about the mental obsession. Why is it, you see? If I think that the distance from my last drink will be sufficient to keep me clear, the longer I'm sober, the more secure I am in my sobriety, well, most of you guys know better than that. Most of you guys have been sitting in meetings with men that are 20 years sober and they're so miserable they can't stand themselves or you. It's a horrible place to be. Horrible. Guys, in the big picture of this thing, look at what's happening. As the clock ticks day by day by day, left unchecked, Daniel's ego will reassert itself and Daniel's selfishness will reassert itself and he will become an animal. He will become as ugly a human being again as there is. He's a nice kid, but I promise you, based on self, which we're getting ready to talk about, it'll be a nightmare. And that's what happens to us. You know, it's like I get up, picture the situation, and I bet you there's nobody in here that hasn't done this. Picture this. I left a meeting last night, and I felt like a spiritual giant. And I go home, I go to bed. And I get up the next morning, and something's not quite right. There's just some uncertainty, some piece of discomfort deep inside. And I look in the mirror and I don't like what I see and my head's already at work and I'm thinking about a bunch of crud and I'm just like, you understand what I'm saying? And now it begins. This thing called a spiritual malady. I'm feeling separate and apart from you and from God and from everybody. It's just an ugly place to be. By the time I get to work, I'm flipping people off. I'm already deciding whether I'm going to quit work or not quit work or whether I'm going to leave her or not leave her. It's just gotten all twisted out of proportion. Nothing happened, guys. Nothing happened to start it. It was just a condition. Left unchecked, I'll be able to handle it for a day or two. Now I've yelled at everybody I know. I've stomped my foot. I've acted like a child. I've done everything that I've done. It's just an ugly place to be. Remember that place? Horrible place to be. My insides are in I'm just so funked out. For a lot of us, from that point, we slide right into the darkest and deepest of depression. That's where we go. That's where I go. That's what scares me more than anything in the whole wide world. I don't want to drink again, not because I want to die drunk. I don't want to drink anymore because I don't want to be depressed anymore. My depression damn near killed me. And I'm not talking about this. Heard this lady one time go, oh yes, I remember being real blue one time and I just like this. Lady, shut up. You don't... We ain't talking blue here. We're talking comatose. We're talking sitting in bed, can't move. That kind of depression. And I see drunks like this all the time. That's the reason why it's so important, guys, that we do something to break that cycle and to get clear of that. And unless that I can have a spiritual connection, and that's the reason why after I've qualified him, the next thing we do is step two stuff. Everybody says, I've heard guys for months, well, I'm working on step two. I'm working on step two. Why? There's nothing to work on, brother. You either believe that there's a loving God out there that's going to fix it or you don't. It's that simple. You don't have to understand all the parameters around it, Mr. Smarty Pants. You don't have to understand all of it. What you have to understand is, do I believe that there's something out there bigger than me? Yes. Check. Step two. Next. Three. See what I'm saying? I mean, Peter always finds more to say about this, but at the end of the day, it's always the same thing. You either believe that God will fix it or you don't believe that God will fix it. Let me show you something real quick. Turn to... There is a solution. Page 24, right at the bottom of that page. Let's do the other one. Go to page 25, bottom of the page. If you're seriously alcoholic as we believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. If we had passed through a region from which there is no return through human aid, which writes off your group, my group will keep me sober. No, they won't. My sponsor, he'll keep me. No, he won't. The book just told me this, and it's not the first time or the second time or the last time that they're going to tell me that. Human aid is a bad place to be. We had but two alternatives, and they're going to lay it out. We could go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. That means we could kill ourselves, drink ourselves to death. And the other was to accept spiritual help. Guys, there is no third door. It's. I'll read that in a minute. There is no third door. I can't offer Daniel a third door. I can't offer him another alternative because there is not one. Daniel will either accept that there is a God. They use a whole chapter, chapter 4, we agnostics, to try to get Daniel's head around the idea of accepting something that he may not be willing to accept. Guys, I'm not stupid about it. I understand that 90% of us come into this thing with God exactly sideways in our craw. You mention God and I get goofy. I understand that. I'm not asking you to accept my God. I'm not asking you to accept my religion. I'm not asking you to accept any of that. I'm asking you to accept the simple fact that you're going to have to, at step three, turn your will and your life over to something. Wouldn't it be a great idea to form some idea? It doesn't have to be a full-formed idea. I don't care if you think God's a grasshopper. I don't give a rat's patootie. But he better be a pretty powerful grasshopper is all I got to say. You know? Right. And so here we are standing at this position with Daniel. Daniel goes, okay, yes, I'm okay. I do believe. I said, great. We're ready to look at step three. And then we do this stuff. Any of you guys ever wonder why Bill Wilson and those guys, when they wrote the book, when they wrote everything from, we always read How It Works in the States. We don't in our group, but a lot of groups do read chapter 5, How It Works. Before every meeting, and you get to the ABCs. And then there's this weird three pages there, 60, 61, 62, and 63. There's this weird little area in there. Do you ever wonder why that stuff was there? Because they start. It's like all of a sudden it goes, and everything changes gears. We were talking about one thing, and now we're talking about something completely different. And then we're getting ready to get off into an inventory deal, but it took me a long time to understand the wisdom of putting that where it did. I want to let's look at a couple of key points on this third step stuff, things that are important for us to understand. I want to read this one little paragraph here at the beginning of the bottom of page 60. There's a little paragraph that says, "The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success." No kidding. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives were good. Now, some of us will believe that and some of us won't believe that. Some of us will believe that on an intellectual basis, but we won't believe it here. Guys, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous a badly burnt drunk, convinced that, yes, there had been some drama in my life, but by and large, I'd been a kind individual, and I had not done anything really serious to anybody. Now, that was my perception of me coming into this deal. And the problem is that that's a load of crap that I sold myself. And I watched thousands of drunks, and I've watched hundreds that I've worked with do the exact same thing. You see? And so there's Bill and those guys are trying to paint this picture. Is he not really trying to be a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Girls, there's nobody on the face of God's green earth that's better at judging this than a woman is. If you're a woman and you've dated a man, you've seen that manifestation, haven't you? Guys, in any given moment, a man could be demonstrative and demanding, or he can be kind and servile. He can be anything you want him to be. or anything he wants to be in order to get what he wants. But it's real obvious in those situations. But you need to make the distinction and pull the line over here. It goes on in every part of our life. Employers see it. Everybody sees it. I'm always running a game. I'm always a different guy depending on who I need to be. Do I need to be kind and loving? Or do I need to be a stand-up, mean boss kind of guy? We just play all these roles. Peter was talking about it last night. We just play 1,000 different roles. And it's no wonder there's no true self that we know. I wouldn't know me if me hit me. I wouldn't. You know what I'm talking about? There's just this inconsistency, this phoniness about most drunks when they come into this deal. Because we've spent an entire life being what we needed to be to get what we wanted. Because selfishness is king. Selfishness is king. Look at the top of page 62, probably the greatest line in the big book, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. It didn't say booze and the crack pipe, that we think is the root of our troubles. It didn't say that. And if they'd asked me, I would have written it that way. That we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Now, sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later place us in a position to be hurt. Oh, I don't like the way this is going. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourself, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. No kidding. How many of you guys came into this thing thinking that you were just a victim? I was molested as a kid, and that's the reason I'm a drunk. I was not allowed to go to school, and so that's the reason why I'm a drunk. I got fired. Fill in the blank. It doesn't make it. My husband left me. Somebody died. And I'm not making light of any of these things, so don't come up and see me and say I'm making light of it. I'm not. I want to weep for the drama that I see in these rooms. We all have horrible things that happen to us on it. The problem is that for most of us, we glom onto something and we make it our touchstone, our reason for being a screwed up unit. I'm bad because this. I never take it to a point of looking at a couple of simple things. I have a physical disease that's different from everybody else, and I have this thing called selfishness and self-centeredness that I honed from the time I was a little bitty kid. And that's what we need to address. Let's look at the prayer, and then I want to back out and flesh out something. We want to talk about a couple of things. Notice in the third step prayer on page 63, halfway down the page, it says, one of the things that it mentions here, what you don't do is eat a bunch of fruit, including prunes, real fast before you do one of these. Just a little speaker note you might want to write down in your big book. Don't eat prunes. This afternoon I'll be up here talking like this, just hold on. Maybe not. Oh, crap. You ever say anything and wish you could take it back to? I seem to do that a lot these days. It's like my wife will hear some of these talks and she'll say, why do you say some of this stuff? I think it was Mike Lawrence or Barefoot Bill in New York one time said that I had a Grand Central Station head, and every time something came in, I felt like I had to get on it. Every time I get these weird thoughts, I got to get on it and ride it all the way out. I don't know. It just... Restraint is the key word here that I seem to be missing. Look at this thing in this prayer. It says, you'd like it if I could find it. There it is. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Why would they put that? Why is it? Why didn't Bill call me and say, Myers, what do you think we ought to put in this prayer? And I said, hey, how about relieve me of the bondage of alcoholism? And Bill would have said, oh, that's good. We'll put that in there. But Bill didn't call me. They wrote it just the way this is. And it's always been an amazing thought for me to think that the way that prayer is written, they don't even talk about this thing. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Let me assure you guys, if you don't catch anything this weekend, if you don't remember anything else about this weekend, I want you to remember this one thing. Booze is not your problem. A crack pipe, dope fiends, whatever the deal is not your problem. Your problem is the bondage of self, and it kicks your butt every morning. And it is there waiting every morning. Let me ask you this question, guys. We're not born bigots. We're not born hateful. We're not born selfish. We're not born any of these ways. What we are, that's not a... These character defects are things that we've honed since we were little kids in short pants. We learn this behavior. I can't get what I want by being witty. I'll get what I want by being sneaky. You see? By lying. The lie works pretty good. She wants a doctor? Yeah, I'm a doctor. I'll be whatever you damn near want me to be. I'll be whatever you want, you see, because what I want is what I want. And that's it. My problem is, I want what I want when I want it. And it drives every decision that I make. Every decision. Peter's going to talk about it in just a minute on this stuff. And from those decisions, that's the reason why it was so important to see the insidious nature of the selfishness before we slid into inventory. You show me a guy that did an inventory and didn't address his selfishness and self-centeredness in a fourth column, and I'll show you a guy that didn't do a fourth step. He didn't do it. And if you were there, go do it again. Go find you a buckaroo to carry you back through that work again. And this time, look at that thing because it drives all the decisions. But let me ask you this question real quick, and then I'm almost done, buddy. Let me ask you this question. How many of you guys were under the illusion that once you stopped drinking, everything would get rosy? Most of us. You guys are shy right now. By this afternoon like this, you'll be yelling out, me. That's what we do. But I thought that was the case. I thought, okay, what I'll do is I'll get the booze out of the picture and then I'll be okay. And what happened was, I took the only solution that I'd ever known to the problems as a young adult and as an adult, the only solution that worked for me, the only solution that connected all the dots and made me somebody, and I took it completely out of the picture. And it's a horrible, horrible place to be. Remember in A Vision for You, there's a little line in there that says, have you a sufficient substitute? That's what this cat asks. Have you a sufficient substitute? What a grand question that is. And it's a question that ran through every one of us. It's a common piece of information that we all had. Trust me on this. You'll remember this. The night you stopped drinking, I'm assuming it was maybe a night, and you're sitting in your room maybe by yourself and you're crying and you know you're screwed up and you know it's a problem here and you say, I'm not going to do this anymore. Pause. And then the next question is there anything that can take the place of this booze? And the answer is, there dang well better be. Because if there is not, you will drink again. You will. And that's what the program was about. Getting us reconnected to something that would connect all the dots and make me whole inside, so I wasn't this loose little goofy cannon out there saying and doing and running through the lives of other people like some kind of knucklehead. Because that's what I do best, you see. Every morning when I get up, I have to make the conscious decision. I hear people say, well, today I choose not to drink. How nice for you. Tell me how that works out, because I don't know. I've never figured that one out. My book tells me that I'm powerless over alcohol, okay? But I can make the choice. I can make the conscious decision every morning to be happy. I can make that decision. Happiness is a decision. We can make that. I can also make the decision to be aware of the fact that self is there getting ready to kick my rear end again. And that's the reason why, isn't it interesting, when you do your 11-step work, when you do your 10-step work during the course of the day, when you do your inventory work, that self and its manifestations are always, of which resentment is one of them, is always included. Self. Booze didn't kick my ass. Self kicked my rear end. And that's why I need to address that stuff. And that's the reason why the meeting and the work that we do in the meeting and the work that we do with these steps as we get him into this deal is so important. So I asked Daniel, I said, are you ready to turn your will and your life over the care of a God that you understand? And he goes, well, I don't really understand this God. I said, Dad, I understand that. I would be shocked if you had a full-formed idea of God right now anyway. I'd be shocked. You see? I don't care whether you have a full-formed idea right now. What I really want you to do is just know that he's out there. And he goes, yes, I do, and I'm willing to do that. I says, great, Daniel, hit your knees. Let's do a little prayer here. And we do. We hit our knees and we say this prayer. And then we get up. And then I want you to notice something real quick. And then Peter's going to step in here right after me like this. It says, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action. Next is an important word. It didn't say tomorrow when you finish lunch. Next means next. We launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal housekeeping, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, that's what he just made on his knees with me. It could have little permanent effect unless at once, followed by a strenuous effect, and blah, 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 and we'll go on down and Peter will cover that stuff. At least at once. It didn't say. How many times have you worked with guys like this who did a third step prayer and then 6 months later they're still making excuses why they can't do inventory? Why can't you? You see what I'm saying? Or a year, 2 years, 5 years. What? And then you wonder why you're a fruitcake. You wonder why you're just, there was a momentum that sets itself up in this book. And you watch it as you read back through there. You'll get into this deal and you begin moving with some speed. And the speed picks up momentum. And as you get into this thing, there is this feeling that, and you don't want to stop that thing. This guy is on a downhill slide towards something that is magical and wonderful. And I want him to get it desperately, and I want him to get it as quick as he can possibly get it. And then we have tens of thousands of us sitting in meetings saying, no, 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 just slow down. This is not a race. This is... Page 24 just told me it is a race, guys. Page 24 told me that I'm not going to remember with sufficient force the pain and suffering. It is a race. It's a race for your very life, your very existence. And sadly, the existence of everybody you know. Everybody that loves you is affected too. It is a race. Stop with the slow down stuff. There is no logical reason to put or postpone this work. None. And if you have one, come see me. Because I'm telling you in this instant, guys, I'm right and you're flat wrong if you think that. I am. And somebody says, well, he's an arrogant little... Listen... I've seen it thousands of times from both directions. I've seen people take years to work the work, and I've watched the damage done. I've watched mediocre sponsors become mediocre sponsors. I've watched people that they sponsored suffer hugely. You might have gotten through it, guys. Let's make this crystal clear, and then I'll shut up mercifully. Let's make this part crystal clear. Middle-of-the-road solution, which I'm going to label that as, take your time to do the work. Middle-of-the-road stuff may work for you, but the literature didn't say it would work for every drunk. So you might on downrange find yourself a guy that's a borderline alcoholic, that's just not, or maybe even not an alcoholic. And your process may work with him. We see this in treatment a lot of times, guys. Guys that walk out of treatment, cured, they're fixed. They probably weren't alcoholic in the first place. Probably. But we have to pay attention to this thing, guys, because the book tells me that if I'll work the work the way the book said it, with the same kind of intensity that the book set out, that you would be guaranteed recovery 100% of the time. And my experience in almost 20 years of doing this is that's true. If you'll work the work with the same intensity that the book laid out, you will be guaranteed recovery from this deadly disease. If you do it any other way, it's a half measures way and you'll get what you get. Remember chapter 5, half measures availed us nothing. And I think that he really meant what he said when he said that. Half measures didn't guarantee you half success. It guaranteed you zippo, nada, nothing. So quit it. So quit it. There's a lot of lives depend on whether or not I can get Daniel through this work quick enough that his ego and arrogance doesn't rekindle itself and he's out there being a knucklehead again. I need to get him through this work fast enough to see what happens. We'll flesh out pieces of this and thanks.